Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am the net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going strong for over 40 years. Every Sunday night at 8 o'clock, we all meet here and discuss science and technology. We teach each other, we learn from each other, and hopefully we have a good time with each other. So I'm glad that you're all out there and have joined us once again, and hopefully it will be another entertaining and informative experience. So let me drop for a second, and I will offer you my usual links. Okay. If you need to reach me and you can't do it via the radio, then email is as good as anything. That would be either for mailbag questions, questions that you can't ask during the technical net for one reason or the other, or if you want to either present a topic or be part of a discussion of a topic or hear a topic. Also, if you have a puzzle, I'm always looking for technical puzzles, preferably the ones that you can't look up using Google in about a tenth of a second. But, you know, if it's an interesting, mind-stretching puzzle, please send it my way. Also, if you have a space or NASA-related story and you'd like to have Paul's opinion about it, you can send me email at mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, it's mailbag at, my call sign is alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. Of course, if you want to go direct to Paul, he has an email address. It's spacenetreport@gmail.com. I have a collection of interesting articles and YouTubes that I pick up through the week. I cut and paste them, and I put them up on a page that's called Roy's Link. The way to get to it is to type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you the link. It's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We have a chat room available to you. Sometimes it's very, very active, and sometimes it's very, very quiet. So if you want to join in on it, you type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to our chat room. We offer an audio stream so that you don't have to use W2LIE.net, which is a very noisy signal these days. I supplied it for the technical net, and some people wanted to have access to it the rest of the week. So it's available most times. Occasionally I have to reset the computers and, you know, things happen. But otherwise, 24/7, you type in technet.ac2gs.com, and that gives you the audio feed. And I always want to remind people, MyKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv, and it has archives of the technical net going as far back as September of 2006. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, let me tell you my plans for tonight. It's kind of slightly different than usual. As always, we will ask if anyone has any questions, accept any kind of comments or questions. Preferably, the early ones should be amateur radio related, although as time goes on, we'll open it wide for any science technology questions. And as I've mentioned before, we can discuss medicine to a degree. I can't get into specifics with people. I cannot treat nor diagnose over the radio. But if you want to discuss basic concepts, more than happy to. Tonight, we have a surprise for you people. Andy's Corner is back. Andy has come up with a presentation, and I'm really looking forward to it. I've kind of penciled him in at the 8:45 point. You know, depending upon questions asked and how long it takes to answer them, that might shift a little bit back or forward. We'll have to see. But so pencil him into your calendar at around 8:45. Will be another installment of a much beloved Andy's Corner. Unfortunately, Paul is with us, but I think he's having some problems. Unfortunately, I believe he caught COVID, and so he's having some coughing problems and such. And I think he's planning to pass on doing the SpaceNet report for tonight. We'll see. But we'll try as best we can. If we run out of steam and we end it all early, so be it. It's been ended early before. So that's the plan. If the universe holds up and the repeater holds up and my radio holds up and everything else holds up. So that's the idea. I will now drop and ask if anyone has any questions or topics for tonight. Give me your first name and your call sign.
82OGB Mobile. Bravo Zulu.
Okay, Craig recognized, Rich recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Okay, hopefully as time goes on, there'll be more participants. Craig, I assume it's a question, because sometimes you check in and you haven't quite come up with what your question's going to be for the night. So is it a question or a comment or just a hello?
Probably say two of the three. Before I do anything, I am going to wish Paul a little get well now. Not soon, now. My radio that I was just working on for the past couple hours, my Kenwood TMV71A, most amateur radio transceivers these days are typically dual band, 2 meter 440. Interestingly enough, in my manual, even though I could technically receive these frequencies, what are your thoughts, Roy, of a radio being able to pick up the 800 megahertz trunk system, which typically falls under police and some other uses, as well as very, like, super high frequencies, like the 1300 megahertz range, because that is what my Kenwood dual band radio can actually pick up.
Okay, you can certainly do that. The problem is that a lot of non-amateur bands have different setups. Trunking has a different setup. It channels information, you know, on some kind of an algorithm. And if you don't have proper circuits to decode the trunking algorithms, you kind of get lost. Certainly with modern day police and such, they tend to be moving to an encrypted technology. So you're not going to get much out of that. Certainly, if you have the means to go up to 1.3 gigs, that means you have the means to go to 1.2, and, you know, we have a repeater at 1.2 gigs, and that's part of the ham bands. It's not used very often. So you can certainly experiment with these non-amateur radio-related bands. Whether or not you'll get any kind of consistent and or interesting transmissions, I don't know. I've known people who, with a straight face, tell me that they've spent time listening to the squawk box in drive-ins. You know, in the old days, I don't know if they still do it, but rather than hardwire the connection when you drive by and you tell them what you want, they actually used RF to accomplish that. And so people used to listen in to find out what people were ordering in the drive-through Burger Kings. It eludes me exactly the curiosity involved in that activity, but you know, human beings are curious things.
I mean, I have my radio scanning right now in channels 200 to 300, which I actually threw all of my police stuff in there. I mean, I kind of wiped all my fire and EMS frequencies and wanted to start over from scratch again. I mean, I could make it a mix of police, fire, and EMS, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to stuff the rest of it, so I'll have to see that. One other thing that I didn't realize with my Kenwood radio, which actually applies to all radio, is the frequency step option in the menu, because there are some UHF frequencies, preferably fire frequencies, that have a very unique number at the end. For example, 453.5575, you actually have to set it to 12.5 in order to get that extra number in there. Otherwise, it'll just round it up or down. It won't be able to keep the frequency even on the VFO side. It's kind of interesting.
Okay. You know, it's one of the little foibles. I think most of my radios, I don't have that many. I have a IC7100 and I have a Flex 6700. I can dial things down to the hertz. They also have adjustable stepping controls. But, yeah, it sort of depends also on the mode of modulation. Frequency modulated transmissions are very forgiving. So you don't necessarily have to be spot on. Amplitude modulation signals, because they have their own reference carrier frequency that we've discussed in the past, are very forgiving. The ones that are terribly non-forgiving are single sideband, because they don't supply that reference carrier. So they're assuming that the frequency you're setting it for is the actual frequency, and if you go off of that, you will either raise or lower the audio frequency range. You'll sound like you're breathing helium or hydrogen hexasulfide, I believe, has a very high density and lowers your voice. But, yeah, sure, you can tweak and adjust and figure things out. That the experimental aspects of amateur radio is one of the many aspects that many people enjoy the hobby for.
Nice that a lot of radios can actually do things you didn't really know about. Not only that, what else could I put out there? Ed also gave me this idea, considering how my radio can pick up 800 megahertz and the 1300. Theoretically, could your antenna pick up frequencies outside of its intended range? Like, for example, 220 or the 800, even if you don't have the actual antenna tuned for those particular frequencies, could you theoretically just receive them only?
Yes, receivers are incredibly much more forgiving than transmitters because of the power, the voltages and such that we're speaking of. In the case of radios, you have a very, very low noise, high gain amplification chain on your receiver that will accept microvolts of power and amplify and demodulate them into communications that you're listening to. It's so that if you have a significant impedance mismatch, you'll get a lot of reflection and a lot of loss and attenuation. But because you require such a little signal to do anything useful, theoretically that's why random bits of wire on shortwave radio receivers have always amused people who own them and works for them. You don't want to go the other way, because if you're transmitting through an impedance mismatch, you're going to have a reflection of a significant amount of power that's going to reflect back into your transmitter's output circuitry and usually burn them out if there's no protection circuit. So, yeah, radio receivers are incredibly forgiving. You will not get as strong a signal on a non-resonant antenna. But you will probably get something.
I do have my new magnetically mounted 19-inch dual bander up on the roof, which I tested earlier with my VTEC tri-bander. And I'm actually full quieting into the machine with that. I thought about tying it into the radio, my main radio, to see what I would sound like with that at 50 watts, but I don't know if that would be a smart idea with such a tiny antenna that's magnetically mounted, and pushing 50 through it would be a smart idea, considering how my antenna is actually higher up now. My main common antenna, I actually was able to find a spot near my roof to actually throw in my diamond mount, and it's not directly on the roof, but it's near the roof, and it's actually higher up, so I'm actually getting a better gain out of it.
Well, that's very good, by the way, AC2GS. As far as the power rating, that's available just in the package that the antenna came in. Any kind of retailer that's trying to sell it to you, it's very easy and usually labeled on all the sites, and you can just look up what is its maximum power handling capacity. It might be capable of operating at 50 or 60 watts. You never know. Sort of has to do with fiddly bits of if there's some kind of coupling mechanism or impedance matching devices hidden away in the base. But I would just do a quick Google search and take a look at the specs, and if it says it's capable of running a maximum of greater than 50 watts, then if you want to, you can do it. Good amateur radio practice is to use the least amount of power for the place you're planning to transmit to. The most that you can get is full quieting. Beyond full quieting is just a waste of electricity.
Yeah, that's true. Plus, something I actually would like to do at some point, although I wouldn't really have the need for it, but it's good to have. I was thinking of going for my GMRS license, and the majority of handheld radios out there, you really would have to get a GMRS radio itself, because the majority of the Baofengs, even though there are still some out there that technically still say 136 to 174, which is actual spectrum, can actually transmit on literally anything, which it really shouldn't. And I do have my BTEC that actually can transmit on anything still, and I threw in my GMRS frequencies on that. And so as long as I had my GMRS license, that would still be considered legal. I kind of wish that a ham radio transceiver would be able to transmit sort of outside, like on GMRS and MERS, but I think being Part 97, it's got to strictly be locked into the ham band.
Yes, the FCC tends to be very strict about that. There was a lot of talk of doing away with importing Baofengs because of that reason. There was talk of banning them. I think, these big box stores, were selling Baofeng radios at one time. I don't know if they still do, but there's still a lot of Baofengs being bought. But, the FCC has a thing against it. As far as GMRS, it's very easy to get a license. You don't have to take any exam. You have to fill out an application, and you have to write a check. But other than that, there's no problem. And if you want to, your license can be used for any member of your family.
KG2PWQ on the side with a comment.
Yes, comment away.
This is KG2PWQ. It's Jordan. I was just listening before, and somebody was talking about the public safety and the trunk system. And I just wanted to make a comment that I don't think it's possible to monitor the trunk system on a single radio frequency receiver. I use the Bearcat SDS-100 that tracks the control channel, and then when it switches to the other frequencies, it automatically follows our conversation. So if you don't have something that can trunk track, you're only going to hear part of the conversation and not the other half.
Well, thank you, Gordon. Yeah, I kind of alluded to that earlier, that you just get little segments unless you buy some radio device that is specifically designed to work with trunking systems. But thank you for expanding upon that.
Ed White, 2H.
Yes, Lou.
About a year or two ago, I did it with two SDR dongles. There's some software out there, I forget the name. And one dongle is listening to the control channel, and the other one is agile, depending on what the first one tells it to do. So it was two dongles and a little bit of software on your laptop, and worked like a charm.
Okay, that's very interesting. I got to look into that. It still wouldn't kind of help Craig because he would be trying to do it from his old radios, not these SDRs and Raspberry Pis. I certainly hope that Raspberry Pis go back down in price. I think they've doubled almost or almost tripled in price because of the chip shortage.
KD2PW2, Jordan, I'm just commenting back. The only other issue is I'm not sure if those are digital. Now they're switching over to the traditional card system, which is totally digital, and I'm not so sure if that setup would be able to monitor that.
Yeah, that's a good point, Gordon. A lot of things are kind of shifting to new technology that unless you unless manufacturers keep up with it, and you tend to not be able to simply get a firmware update that fixes things. Eventually, who knows, a lot of things are going to end up being software-defined radios, and those can actually be heavily modified just through firmware alone, but our old legacy receivers with IF stages and mixers and all kinds of fun stuff, not so much. So, yeah, that's another point, that when trunking systems shift from analog to digital, that's going to be a hiccup as well.
That's why the only radio that I'm aware of that can really do it is the Bearcat SDS-100 mobile unit handheld, or the SDS-200, which is the base unit. And that's all set up for the 25, the DMR, and all these new systems that are coming out now that are totally digital.
Ah, very good. You know, it's a shame. I think the club used to have a scanner a net. I think that kind of faded away because I haven't heard it in a long time. But, yeah, scanning technology has to advance. Unfortunately, I know a lot of guys with wonderful scanners from the 90s that have a lot of limited capability these days just because all the transmission modes are changing with the times.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
I haven't heard it in, like, years, and I haven't even heard it at all for the first time. So I don't know why we discontinued it suddenly or it's just not around anymore. I mean, I'm happy with the frequencies that I have right now, and I certainly would like to add a lot more because I like listening to public service when I'm mobile. I got a friend in Riverhead that does the same thing, especially when I'm in town, and you can't really throw an actual scanner in the car, like a Uniden scanner, because then if the cops pull you over, they won't like that, since New York State, you can't have an actual scanner that can pick up police frequencies, but if you're using an amateur radio license with a ham transceiver, that is exempted from that. But, yeah, there's certainly a lot more things I'd like to add on here. And I still don't get why the frequencies they would use would be encrypted. I mean, there's really no secrets. I mean, if anybody really wanted to listen to any kind of frequency, if it were publicly posted, then you can add it into your radio.
Good.
Yeah, one at a time. John, VDH, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention a lot of the public service police are going encrypted. I know I used to listen to First Precinct Nassau County, and I think pretty much all of Nassau County police are P25 encrypted. Which is that ambi audio, but it is encrypted, so that's proprietary encryption. I think pretty much most of Long Island police, public service police frequencies are going to digital P25 encrypted. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with you. Just alluding to something that Craig mentioned, you know, just knowing the frequency, that's sort of the problem. I don't know if you recall, but about a year and a half ago, when there were Black Lives Matters problems and such, someone somewhere recorded the police department's idle chit-chat. And it got rebroadcasted on a bunch of cable news outlets, and they had a public relations storm. So most law enforcement agencies really would rather you not listen to what they say on the radio. I assume that the fire department doesn't really care, but who knows? We live in paranoid times. We lack a lot of privacy, and so some people are kind of overcompensating and demanding even more privacy. So although it sounds benign to just listen in, it can have repercussions. Now, someone other than you, Craig, wanted to say something. Who is that? I think it was Lou.
Yeah, let me see if I have it.
TPC.
Yeah, let me see if I have it. I heard Rich in there too. Roy, you recognizing me right now?
Yes, there's a little bit of noise, a little bit of hiss in the background, but I can hear you.
All right, I'll go on my close machine. All right, first of all, the scanner net, net control, Joe, decided he didn't want to do it, so that's why we don't have a scanner net. Secondly, if you go to rtl-sdr.com and you look up one word, that's the system where you can take two SDRs and a computer, and it will track trunk channels for you. It's called Unitrunker.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I'm very familiar with RTL-STR. It's run by a guy who's really into those inexpensive SDR dongles. His name is it's very easy for me to remember. His name is Carl Laufer. He has the same last name as me, but no relation. I think he's a New Zealand gentleman.
T2 Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
Suffolk County is still unencrypted, but I don't know. I wonder if anybody else knows if there's been any talk about encrypting all of Suffolk County. But as of now, it's still unencrypted. And I wonder also, how does trunking technology work? How does your radio, if it's equipped with following trunk signals, how does it follow them? Go ahead.
I can't make out what you're saying. You're about 80-90% noise and occasionally dropping out.
Okay, I moved my location. Can you hear me better now? Go ahead.
Much, much better.
As far as what I know about the encryption, Suffolk County is not encrypted now, but they're using both systems. They're using the 800 megahertz old system, and then they're using the 700 megahertz new 25 system, and they're both in the clear and monitorable on all their channels. When Nassau County had their system, they started out this way, where they were still using the old 477 C-band, and then once they get the system working and they're happy with it, they turn off the C-band, and that's when it takes a matter of years before they're happy with it, and then what they do is then they decided to encrypt Nassau. But I understand that Suffolk may not do it.
WB2LBQ for a comment.
Yes, comment.
Yeah, WB2LBQ. Is somebody in public service in Suffolk County. Suffolk County has enough problems getting their radios together in the clear, much less getting them encrypted. I think that's probably pie in the sky.
Well, for the short term, probably. For the long term, inevitably, someone's nephew is going to be a minor cog in a telecommunications company that's selling encrypted transmission equipment to municipalities. And eventually, I think the future of most most municipality communications are going to be encrypted. You know, we can't do that as amateur radio operators because it's part of the FCC 97 rule. You cannot encrypt your communications, and you cannot use unpublished, easily breakable algorithms. So digital algorithms that can be perceived as partially as encrypted, are as long as you publish the algorithm, are unencrypted. But we're going to be far away from it, but I think most commercial companies are going to tend towards it because of the general paranoia of the world.
Yeah, just remember that post 9/11, interoperability and talking in the clear was a priority. But that was, of course, a long 20 years ago, WB2LDQ.
Yes, and we human beings, unfortunately, have very short memory spans. Anyway, getting back to what Rich was asking, the best way that I could explain trunking is that it is a multi-channelized situation. There is a control channel that spits out where you should listen and transmit for the next segment of your conversation, and it will change over time. So the radios usually are dual receivers. They're receiving the channel information, either analog or digitally, and that can control the channelized switching mechanism for the second tuner in your radio.
Okay, did you have to be comment?
Yeah, sure. Please comment.
There is no dual receive. It's only a single receiver.
Okay. I mean, theoretically, you could probably do it too. But so what happens? It kind of time slices and goes back to the trunking frequency?
When you get a voice grant and you're affiliated with that talk group, you jump to the assigned voice channel, and you remain on that voice channel until you're either timed out, which, for example, on Motorola is the default of 3 seconds in most code plugs, or you're commanded back or preempted.
Okay, so basically you're jumping back between the trunking command frequency and the talk group frequencies.
You're not jumping between transmissions. You can stay on the talk path, the voice channel, until the conversation is over.
Okay, but what happens if you time out?
After you time out, you would revert back to the control channel.
Okay, so that makes sense. I thought they finessed it a little bit with the dual channel because it's not that difficult these days to have multiple tuner radio systems. But okay, so it's a one tuner system in a changeable, channelized environment.
CD2PWQ, Jordan back. Also, something that's interesting is happening is that private systems, networking systems, like the One Voice Network, which is very big in the metropolitan area, are actually hosting local police departments, fire departments, and actually building their own systems.
Oh, okay.
It's BC.
Yes, Rich.
It's BC. Roy, do you know if it's legal for a ham radio operator to be on their radio, talking on their radio while in motion? B2LGB Mobile.
Okay, Craig recognized that kind of opens a bag of worms, and eventually someone will show you that there is a letter that you're supposed to make a copy of and hold on to it in case you're stopped by a police officer, that amateur radio operators are able to operate. a lot of amateur radio operators, if they see anything close to a police officer anywhere nearby, they take the microphone and they put it down in the dashboard to make it very less obvious that they're doing any communications. But, Craig, you want to add to that?
Yeah, KD2OGB. I actually also want to wrap this up because I'm parked and where I got to be. I've used my microphone dozens of times with police behind me and have not had a problem. Technically, there isn't really an exemption to New York State. I mean, some states do have exemptions to it, which, yes, you do need to keep on you. But DMV, I remember Lou said this one time, that DMV has an opinion on amateur radio where it's not a wireless telephone. And, yes, you technically can use it, and it's based on police discretion and judge discretion. Some will say yes, some will say no, some won't care, or whatever. But, yeah, it virtually depends on police discretion. There isn't really any right or wrong answer to this. It all depends on if you do get pulled over, what's the cops going to say, even if you're not talking on it and you're just listening. And also, getting back to the police frequencies, most of the law dispatch channels actually lurk on VHF and are still pickable, so that's typically what I listen to before I wiped the radio, and I heard, like, maybe 70% of them, so you could still listen to some things. If you guys want to continue this, feel free. Thank you very much, Roy. AC2GS, Net Control, KD2OGB Mobile.
You're welcome, Craig, and as we've kind of been batting this around, there are places and things that you could listen to, but the nature of technology will suggest that it will be less inclusive and more walled off in many different ways as time progresses. So, you know, people who have a scanner that they just bought today, even if it's a Bearcat, eventually there will be some point in the future where things that they would like to listen to will be unavailable to them. It's just the nature of transmission technology and the psychological aspects of the human mind. But thanks for participating, Craig.
Problem, and there really needs to be a revision to how amateur radio operators are treated while they are mobile, especially considering that I have plates, and even if police see that, they still will tend to go for you. But, I mean, think about it. What do CDers use? What do tow trucks use? What do police, fire, and EMS use? What do utility companies use? And what do we use? Two-way radio equipment while we're mobile. So if everybody else gets those, then how do you think they should really treat us? Anyway, 73 is KD2OGB Mobile. Back to Net Control.
Okay, very good, Craig. I don't know for a fact, but I tend to think that CBers don't get anything from the police. So if you stop by the police, I think you're stuck. If a policeman is using a radio, they let other policemen use their radios. They'll let fire department use their radios. Government agencies don't give each other tickets. So that's a kind of different ball of fish entirely. But thanks for participating. Rich, I was wondering, I usually we have wonderful conversations and discussions and lots of questions and lots of answers. It's sort of coming up to 8:40, and I'd like to see if Andy's there for Andy's Corner. I don't want you to feel bad if I kind of move you to the other side of the line. Would you mind that?
Oh, in fact, I'm sure what Andy has to present is a lot more interesting than my questions. So please bring Andy on.
Okie dokie. Thank you very much, Rich. Andy, WA2CDL, are you out there?
Yes, I am. WA2CDL, this is Andy Escorto. Good evening. Good evening. I've been listening in. Kind of interesting with the police department because I'm retired from NYPD, so I can I can tell you a lot of stuff, but not on the air. You know, there are certain things that have to be, you know, not spoken about. For obvious reasons. Anyway, this is Eddie's Corner. Good evening. It's been a while since I've been on the air, and I've been cleaning out, sorting things out, and I've come across some articles that I've copied and filed and stapled together and so on, and I gave a list of what I found so far to Roy this past week, and we came across a few of them that sound interesting, so I'm going to give it a go and see how this works out. I'll try my best to work, and if this conveying information, if anybody's interested in this kind of stuff, the way Dick used to say it, all this jazz, he had a good way of putting it, because there is a lot to learn, and more so than just, you know, just than having idle chit-chat back and forth and so on, because that could be saved for other times when there's no net. But doing a TED net, and I want to keep it technical, because that's what it's about, you know, technical stuff, and stuff that's pertinent to amateur radio, or at least we'll try anyway. So, I came across one article here that I spoke to Roy about, and it's called Electrical Noise in Semiconductors. By the way, I'm only going to do this, this particular article is 26 pages long. I'm going to see if I can spread it out through a couple of weeks. I'm not going to do the whole thing in one night because, first of all, I don't have the time tonight anyway. We'll see how much we get done in like a half an hour or so. I told Roy about a quarter after 9, maybe 9:30 or so, 45 minutes. For my discussion. Let me just unkey. I know I'm going to time it out, even though I'm listening to myself like I normally do. So in the physics of noise and the discussion of noise, noise is a very broadband issue. It's, you know, we deal with noise all the time. Some people have heard of certain techniques and circuits that reduce noise, like Dolby. You know, for instance, if you've heard of Dolby noise reduction, you know, that's was a common name, a household name, that when you bought a piece of audio equipment, you would hear this, and it was pertinent to tape recorders because of the hiss that is generated from magnetic tape, and so on. So there's just one area of noise. There's thermal noise. There's white noise. There's pink noise. There's audio noise. There's sun noise. You know, it's a very broad spectrum. So in dealing with that, and noise is fascinating because you know, we have radios that actually generate noise in the radio itself, and one of the specifications, you know, for a radio to be designed properly is to have a good signal to noise ratio. And most of you have heard that term, signal to noise. Now, what is the signal and what is the noise is the question. What are we talking about? So we can get into a little bit of that discussion, because this article, let me unkey. Okay, I was going to slip on the mic. This article here is Electrical Noise in Semiconductors. And this article was actually written back in 1952. So this is old, but it's good stuff, because back then, you know, that's when experiments and discoveries were made, and the semiconductor was relatively new, because the transistor basically was invented at Bell Labs in the late 40s. So this wasn't you know, too long after that occurred. Of course, now, noise occurs in every component. There is a, and Dick has spoken about noise. There's noise is generated in resistors, in filters, passive devices, active devices. You know, wherever there's some thermal activity, you're going to generate noise. So, as I said, you know, I'm just alluding to the fact that it's a broad subject. So if anybody's interested in noise and semiconductors, you can listen to what this article has to say, and that's what I'm going to convey. Roy, any questions from you, Roy, so far? Everything good?
Fine by me.
All right, just want to make sure because I hear some erroneous signals in the background. So I'm going to start, and I'll see how many pages I can get through. Now, there are some, graphs that are shown here. And, you know, again, I'm not getting into any math. I'm not getting into anything that you really have to write down and understand. So I'm just trying to read directly. By the way, here's an interesting question. I'm just going to ask the general audience, because I've asked this question before, and I believe that I'm right about it. And that has to do with the sun. You know, the sun, radio astronomers use the sun to calibrate their receivers because the sun generates noise, you know, well into the gigacycle range. And microwave enthusiasts use that. They use the sun as a source, and then they calibrate to the sun and compare it to a non-sun, which they call cold sky. And, you know, Dick has mentioned that before many times. So if you've ever been to a microwave symposium or a meet where they have a contest, it's actually a contest where they see how far they can transmit at 24 gigs, 10 gigs, whatever gigacycle range that that's allowed on the band. So anyway, getting back to the sun, the sun generates noise, as we know, all sorts of noise. Roy's mentioned that before. So the question is, and this question has been asked a number of times, if the sun generates noise that we can hear, even though it's obviously, as you know, it's millions of miles away. If the sun, if we can hear the noise, I would believe that it would be pretty loud. It could be devastating. And the question is, and just see if anybody can come up with the answer: how come we don't hear the sun making noise, or noise that we can hear? You know, noise that our ears would hear. That's the question. Anybody have the answer?
BDH with a comment.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, you're talking about audio noise versus RF noise. The sun is in a vacuum 93 million miles away, so we're not hearing any audio noise.
Okay, well, we recognize, yes. Well, that's exactly right. It's in a vacuum. Sound can't travel in a vacuum. But the truth is, I've asked this question to many people over the years. My father was a science teacher, and he actually asked me the question way back when. And the obvious answer is, to most people, it's too far away. Now, think about that for a second. That would be like the first answer that people would give. The sun is just so far off, we don't hear it. And, of course, that's not the truth. So, just thought I'd throw that in. Wesley, go ahead.
actually, it has a radio. So I'll be repeating the same stuff that the sound doesn't reach across the vacuum space. But there are slow waves that we can see moving on the surface. Now, there's additional thing that you were talking about the noise in frequency much higher than the frequency that we can hear, and that's 20 hertz or 20 kilohertz. That propagates through the medium. So since we don't have a medium that could carry on noise at this frequency, we cannot hear it. Enter here.
AC2GS?
Yeah, okay, Roy.
Yeah, also, you got to realize that this is pretty much black body radiation. So the surface of the sun is putting out around 6,000, 7,000 Kelvin. So approximately the sweet spot where Dick used to mention that he did the calibrations is in the S-band. So that's around 2 gigahertz. So you have to have really good ears. They're electrical noise. It's not acoustic pressure wave noises. But even if it was acoustic pressure wave noise, you'd have to have damn good ears to hear a signal that's 2 gigahertz.
Okay, Charlie, should be.
Yes, exactly. Exactly right. I only mentioned that because of the question that was always asked of if we could hear it, you know, if there was a possibility of us hearing the actual frequency that the sun would generate, would we hear it? And of course, the answer would be no. That's the whole point. The other station, go ahead.
It seems everyone keeps falling back to the concept of EMF noise, but, you know, it's also worth considering if the sun also makes mechanical noise. And, you know, there are people who are going to say, oh, you know, it's in a vacuum, so, you know, there's no medium to it, you know, for sound to travel, mechanical noise sound to travel through that. Or, you know, it's too far away to hear. I would beg to differ.
Well, if you keep in mind solar winds and such, yeah, it kind of brings its own pressure waves.
Vibrating particles, but they are too far away from each other.
Okay, very good. Let me just... All right. Yeah, I got off a little bit of a tangent just mentioning the sun because it was a question. But I'm going to start this this article on semiconductors because that's what this is about. And we're not, as opposed to other types of noise generated, which, again, you know, again, is a broad subject. So let me just unkey a second. I'm going to start here. Okay, and thanks for everybody's comments. Really good. So anyway, electrical noise is semiconductors. And... I'm just going to read what it says here because it is kind of interesting. Again, I won't go into any formulas or math or any graphs or anything like that. So it says here, transistors, diodes, and single crystal filaments of germanium have common noise properties, a spectrum varying inversely with frequency. Now that's important, inversely with frequency, and strong dependence on the biasing current. Now, biasing is how we bias transistors. Theoretical attempts to explain this noise are reviewed briefly. Experiments with single crystal filaments indicate that the noise resides in the behavior of the minority carrier. Now, I'm not going to go into minority carriers because that's how semiconductors operate, basically. Roy could explain that one. In one type of experiment, the correlation of noise voltage is voltages in adjacent partitions of a filament is quantitatively related to the lifetime and transit time of minority carrier. In another, the effect of a magnetic field on the noise found in accord with calculated changes and lifetime of the minority carrier. Now, this whole paragraph sounds a little bit convoluted and crazy and so on, but that's what it says. So that's just a prelude, basically. So it says here, in the development of the transistor, it was recognized quite early that electrical noise in the device was considerably in excess of Johnson noise. Johnson noise, by the way, is like random noise, like Nyquist noise. There's different names for noise that's been identified by various scientists. So they're calling it here Johnson noise. Particularly at low frequencies. Noise having a similar spectrum had been observed many years earlier in microphone carbon contacts carrying a current, and in copper oxide rectifiers, composition resistors, and crystal diodes. So there's something interesting right there, because noise is actually generated in those components. Let me unkey. Okay, thanks. Flicker noise in vacuum tubes appears to be a related phenomenon. A number of attempts have been made to determine the mechanism of production of noise of this sort, but none have been particularly successful. Okay, so vacuum tubes also have some noise that's generated. We know this because they have there have been experiments that have been done in the vacuum tubes, and their noise figure or factor that they produce. So in this paper, we will first survey the more important characteristics of noise in germanium diodes and transistors. This will be followed by a partial hypothesis as to the nature of the noise mechanism. We will then discuss experimental work on noise in filaments of single crystal germanium carrying a DC current. These experiments strongly support the hypothesis that, in fact, led to the formulation in the first place. Let me unkey. I hope everybody's with me so far. That's pretty straightforward. Let's see. So if I wander off, just get me back on track, because I'm going to be reading this, and I didn't really read the whole thing. I sort of skimmed over it, and to get some ideas of how deep this is going to go. And it's not too mathematical. There are some basic formulas, but we're not going to go there. All right, so, and again, if anybody's listening in, it's Andy's Corner, and we're talking about noise. Again, this is 25 pages, so I'm not going to do all 25. Maybe two or three. Just to get everybody's feet wet, so to speak. So here we go. Noise in diodes and transistors. And there are many similarities in the noise phenomena found in diodes and transistors of both the point contact and junction type. It seems likely that the noise mechanism is similar in all these devices. And by the way, point contact is one of the first transistors that was developed. It was called a point contact transistor, usually using germanium or some other substance at the time. One of the most characteristic features of the noise in such structures is the spectrum. The spectral density, which is density is actually the power unit bandwidth, varies inversely as the frequency according to the relation. Now, they give a little formula here for it, but I won't even mention the formula because it's no one's going to use it. But the bottom line is that the spectral density varies inversely as the frequency goes up. The spectral density goes down. And it goes, it says here where the exponent lies between 1 and 1.5 because they're showing, they're relating it to a formula with an average about 1.2. This, okay, so this is what I shouldn't mean. So this type of spectrum will be referred to as the 1 over F spectrum. Let me just let it drop a second because I just want to read this paragraph.
Repeater, timeout. Repeat.